you just said, though, about law. Give me that date again on that one session, if you've got your finger in it.
October 19th, 1951, Lefty. In the studio, put down songs like I Love You, Though I Know You're No Good. You're Here, So Everything's All Right. One or two other songs. And next to the original log sheet in Don Law's handwriting is NG, next to each song. For No Good. And, you know, that was a call that I'm sure Don made. He heard what was going on that day, and who knows? I mean, it could be a million and one things. They were, you know, just plain old having a bad day. You know, Lefty was having throat problems. Who knows? Mm-hmm. But he brought them back in, you know, 3 months later. They basically recut all the songs, and those are the versions that were issued.
Right.
And, you know, that happens all the time, and I don't mean to be jumping around here, but Ken Nelson would do the same thing with Buck Owens. I mean, they'd be in, and going through the session tapes, if it wasn't going to be a productive session, you could see where Ken would stop it after like two tracks,
mm-hmm.
and just literally say, okay, you know, let's call this. Let's get back in here tomorrow morning and see what happens tomorrow. And sure enough, you know, the next day would be the magic day, and all kinds of work was done and everything. And even, you see, that's the thing that's most intriguing to me about country performers as opposed to rock and roll performers, and I don't mean this to be disparaging at all towards rock and roll performers, but country guys were nailing this stuff in 1 to 3 takes.
Right.
I mean, you listen to Bob Wills' lacquers from the 30s and the 40s, it's pretty much, for all intent and purposes, although like Don Law was involved later on and stuff, it's the band producing themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when Eldon Shamblin blows a guitar solo, the whole band stops and you hear them laugh. You know?
Yeah.
And then they kick up the next take. And that's intriguing to me. I mean, just to hear that many musicians, like in the Texas Playboys, number one, in essence, producing themselves.
Right.
Number two, nailing this stuff in 2 or 3 takes.
Right. And so much of that being a consequence of the technology itself.
Yes, absolutely.
And hence, so country ends up heading toward more produced recordings, both as a result of the coming of tape and the consequent coming of rock and roll, which is virtually predicated on tape.
Right.
Absolutely. Yeah. But it does sound to me, let's take the case of Lefty Frizzell a little further, that those things are produced in the modern sense of the word fairly early. I mean, there are arrangements on there. You know, there'll be decisions made. Now, some of this happens, I guess, at the moment tape arrives. You know.
Yeah. I think that you start to see the big change occurring in, I think, probably the latter half of the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it took analog tape literally a good, you know, 4, 5, 6 years before it differed enough from cutting to an acetate. Well, I probably with the advent of multi-tracking, you know, when
right.
Nashville got its first half-inch 3-track recorders in 1958, you know,
mm-hmm.
that's when, you know, the whole arena pretty much changed. Up till that time, they were still recording to full-track mono tape.
Yeah.
It was just a different medium than the lacquer. You know?
Mm-hmm.
So
it just meant they didn't have to do as many safety,
you
know, sorts of, enact as many safety devices, yeah.
Right.
Is Don Law still alive?
Yes.
Okay.
Last I knew.
Yeah.
Geez, I would fact check that. Last I knew he was.
Right, right. Actually, I talked to Ken Nelson a few days ago.
Oh, good. Yeah.
Yeah, he's 88 years old.
Yeah.
Has a great memory.
You bet. And just, you know, absolutely one of my favorite country producers of all time.
Yeah.
I mean,
what do you admire about him?
Oh, I just think it was one of those things where just every single planet that could be aligned was aligned. I mean, I couldn't imagine a more friendly, studio-friendly artist other than Buck. mm-hmm. you know, showing up. And the chemistry with Ken Nelson was just magic. They still speak so highly of each other.
Mm-hmm.
That's rare.
You know?
And, you know, Buck will be the first one to say, no one can touch those Ken Nelson productions.
Right.
You know, and I mean, it's just amazing to see that chemistry live on. And when you put on, you know, one of Buck's master tapes from a studio perspective, from a technical perspective, they were so well recorded. It's scary.
Yeah.
I mean, when I first got the first batch of session tapes from Buck, I put them on, and it was just jaw-dropping. They sounded so good.
Mm-hmm.
The bass was so well recorded. The drums were so well recorded. Don Rich's Telecaster was the clearest Telecaster ever to cut through on a record at that time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and as far as I'm concerned, defined that sound as much as, you know, Luther Perkins, you know, let the world know that, you know, the Telecaster was the country guitar.
Right, right.
You know, at least that's the first place I ever heard it when I was a kid, and I didn't really know exactly what it was I was listening to, other than that guitar was just something that I had to know more about.
Yeah. Now, were the tapes in good shape when you got them?
Yeah, perfect shape, because Buck had, sure quite how he acquired his tapes from Capitol Records. I'm sure there was some sort of, you know, purchase agreement, whatever, but, you know, he recognized the value of those masters at a time when, you know, the big record company did not.
Yeah.
And wisely so, and took them into his own possession and, you know, stored them like they were his children, which they were.
Right.
And just kept them in wonderful shape. And he has a wonderful staff there that just cares so much about the history of Buck and everything, that they all play a big part in that.
Well, I would assume that that's not necessarily the case with the Flat and Scruggs, Bob Wills, and Lefty Frizzell material. Is that Columbia didn't treasure that the same way, or am I wrong?
Well, they treasured it. The problem is with a company of that size, and I don't mean to paint this as a problem. It's not a problem. It's just something that's inherent in a company of that size. Is that over the period of years, you know, there's changeover in personnel in every department. Procedures are done differently, and tapes are logged differently, and they're stored differently. And they're valued differently, you know. And that doesn't necessarily add up to a tragedy, but what it adds up to is before I can start a project like a Lefty Frizzell or a Flat Scruggs, it takes a lot of work just to put the puzzle together and find all the masters.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, probably the person that will sing that song the loudest to you would be my friend Richard Weitz at Bear Family.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you know Bear Family.
Yeah, right.
Who, you know, when he's, to this day, he's still laughing with me about searching down, you know, the 3 or 4 missing Johnny Cash masters he's never been able to find or something. And just a couple of weeks ago when I saw him, he had great news, because he had indeed, with the help of some people at the Sony Archive, uncovered some tapes that he had been looking for 10 or 15 years.
Yeah. Now, had he gotten to Lefty Frizzell before you did at Columbia?
I don't know when his set came out.
Uh-huh.
You know, we share information, and certainly if one of us has found a set of tapes or a session that the other has been looking for, you know, we're on the phone with each other right away.
Mm-hmm.
But on the Lefty Frizzell, I didn't rely on, you know, the Bear Family sources to do that set. You know, that was all done from the absolute original
mm-hmm.
analog tapes and the original lacquers.
Yeah.
But
I would assume that Don Law, if Lefty Frizzell is drinking pretty heavily,
right.
I would assume that Don Law doesn't note that, or does he?
No.
Okay.
No.
So you would be left to wonder.
Yeah, the contracts are they're actually called contract cards. At least this was the Columbia system of doing these things. They're basically just ledgers that are typed that will give you, you know, the studio date, the matrix number that was assigned to the song, the title of the song, the publisher, and who is paid for what, and at the end of the column, where that particular track was or was not issued.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they're invaluable when you're, you know, doing what I do down there.
Yeah.
There's about the only handwritten notes of the things that, you know, where someone just goes in after the session and says, no good, remade.
Right.
That kind of thing.
Well, let me get you to jump in time and talk to me about, in your work with the birds, your observations about Gary Usher's production with them.
Okay. Well, I can tell you right off the bat that it's going to be a very biased opinion because Gary Usher is probably one of my most favorite producers in the world.
Yeah, go ahead.
why?
Yeah. No, I'm happy to hear that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm happy to hear that because I've wondered, you know, to what extent did he bring the birds to country music? That's one of the things I'm interested in, too.
Okay. Well, I can tell you this. Gary, first off, just speaking in generalities, you know, he and I had a friendship before he passed away because I had begun working on some of his material. And we very much hit it off together. And I had always been in awe of his work, you know. And even though he had been doing a lot of things before that, the first place I remember seeing name and knowing that a producer very obviously contributed something to the sound of a record was on the Byrds' Younger Than Yesterday album.
Mm-hmm.
When working with the Byrds, speaking more specifically about Gary Usher, I know for a fact that he didn't necessarily bring the Byrds around to country music. You know, that was just a natural progression brought to the Byrds through Chris Hillman and, of course, eventually Graham,
mm-hmm.
and people like that.
It was in the air, in a sense, you're saying, too,
yeah,
at that time.
Yeah, and, I mean, Roger, of course, you know, and had, you know, all of his folk roots, as did the other guys. Chris Hillman had all of his bluegrass roots, and it was very much a natural progression. They brought in Gary Usher to help them define that and refine that.
Mm-hmm.
Gary Usher, if nothing else, with the Byrds, I can't say it that way. He was everything to the Byrds, but along with being such a wonderful producer, was the best diplomat and arbitrator you've ever seen.
Mm.
You know, because when you go through the session tapes, a lot of them are not pretty.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just trying to hold that damn boat together.
Right.
You know. But I think that Gary was just, you know, born to be the Byrds producer.
Mm-hmm.
Although I'm fond of other producers' work, of course, especially Terry Melcher, but that's a different lifetime of the Byrds, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Alan Stanton was probably the producer that bridged the gap, you know, on the 5D album, where you had an album that was kind of like you knew that something was going to happen with the next album because they were leaning all over the place, you know, going from a song like Wild Mountain Time to 8 Miles High on the same record,
right,
and still having that record hold together. And you know, on Younger Than Yesterday, of course, and I could go on for days, Mike, about the Byrds, but I'll try not to do that. On Younger Than Yesterday, you know, was the first time that Clarence White was performing with the Byrds, too.
Uh-huh.
And boy, oh boy, once Clarence White walked in the studio, how could you help but not feel that influence with his playing,
mm-hmm.
you know? And I think that is what set the light bulb off over certainly Chris Hillman's head, because Chris, you know, was writing songs like Time Between, like that, for the Younger Than Yesterday album.
Well, when you listen to that album, what do you hear on it that you say, that's Gary Usher, and that's what a real producer does?
I hear the production techniques, and I hear the depth of the recording. And I'll say this off the record, so I'm not disparaging towards other producers. Terry Melcher had a very, very unique sound, and it was a sound that worked well in the Byrds' early days, and it's a sound that Terry applied to a lot of other artists, like Paul Revere and the Raiders, you know, at Infinitum. I mean, there's a lot of artists that he used that sound with.
Mm-hmm.
Good producer, but I'm sure it was the Byrds' decision that they needed to do something more. They wound up with Alan Stanton doing the 5D album, and this is very much off the record. You know, Stanton was, you know, pretty much doing crossword puzzles and smoking cigarettes,
mm-hmm.
and not producing the band. So the band knew they had to do something to get back on track. I don't know if they chose Gary Usher at the beginning or if Gary Usher was assigned to the band.
Yeah.
I don't know that.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as you put on Younger Than Yesterday, coming from an album like 5D, which was an album filled with marvelous songs and wonderful ideas that suffered from the production end of things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in retrospect, it's cherished because of its crunchy, distorted, you know, overdriven kind of sound that's on the guitars and stuff. But when you put on Younger Than Yesterday, I mean, it is, you know, clean as country water.
Right.
The recording is absolutely a flawless production in the sonic sense of the word without being sterile.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the magic to me, is having, you know, very often a producer can attain a clean, wonderful sound, and the recording puts you to sleep. It's a snooze fest. It's sterile and it's not exciting. But having a well-recorded album that still pushes all of your hot buttons, you know, in terms of performance and, you know, the choice of songs and just the sonic of the album, the sonics of the album, that's where Usher's magic was.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He did not drain the band artistically at all.
Yeah.
He pushed them artistically, kept them in top form, and put out a sonically wonderful record almost every time.
Yeah. Now, if I sat down, I mean, you'd have to play inordinately dumb to go along with this game. But if I
can do that,
well,
you know.
Yeah, so can I. So if I played you a group of recordings and said, can you tell just from listening to these recordings whether this is a Don Law production? Is there a way that you would say, yeah, there's a telltale sign right there? In other words, I guess what I'm hearing with Gary Usher comments is that, all right, even though he's not imposing a personality on the recording, let's say like Phil Spector would
right.
do, right? But there's nevertheless a clarity there that you would say, look, he's not obtrusive, but I hear him there.
Right.
And I'm curious whether that has come of age yet with someone like Don Law, especially early on, because certainly later with Johnny Cash, you know, you're in another age of production.
Well, I think that you're exactly right, that that's when a producer can start revealing himself. You know, it's a good question, and it's not one I'm sure I have the answer to off the top of my head, but in the earlier days when people were recording to lacquer or to full track mono tape, I really do believe that, not just in Don Law's case, but in most producers' case, it was much more in an A&R capacity than a producer. They let the groups be themselves more. And I could be wrong about that in some people's eyes, but that's certainly the way that I see it. I can't hear outside of you know, certain miking techniques or something like that, which was, I'm sure, more the engineer's responsibility than a producer's. Not in every case. And
right.
I could be wrong about that, because maybe Don Law was sitting there saying, no, 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 I don't want that sound like that. I want the mic over there.
Mm-hmm.
But for argument's sake, I'm going to bet that most of the time that was the engineer
mm-hmm.
that was doing that. And it's not as easily revealed on the early recordings. Certainly, once you start hitting the mid to late 50s, the early 60s especially, you can hear, you know, producers' trademarks all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that was so much the case in the 30s and 40s.
Right.
People weren't picking producers. Producers were pretty much assigned, or the producers were doing the picking
yeah.
of which artists they were going to work with.
Right. They function more as documentarians. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
So when do you first, and sticking still with these country people, when do you first start to see that someone is actually physically cut, edited the tape? Are they doing that with Lefty Frizzell or with Flatt & Scruggs?
What do you mean?
I mean, where there's an edit, there's actually cut one section out because it was a better take, and instead of retaking the thing,
well,
does that happen?
Sure it does.
Does it happen in the late 50s?
Yeah, I think it happens in the early 50s.
Really?
Sure. Well, as soon as people were able to cut something, I mean...
Yeah, they started doing it.
Well, as soon as they figured that out. Because, you know, and there's just nothing wrong with that in my mind's eye. I mean, if you're sitting there with Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys in 1951 recording to analog tape, and they do two takes of a song, and, you know, Leon McAuliffe or Elton Shamlin or someone just like burns it up on a solo on a given take.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's anything wrong with putting that solo in.
Oh, I don't think there's a thing wrong with it, but I guess the follow-up question would be, have you seen an instance of that where you say, boy, this is pretty interesting the way they were able to do that, that created a almost like in a filmic way, it created a composition that never existed in the studio, and here's how they were able to hide that cut.
Sure. I mean, I've seen hundreds of examples of that.
Do you recall one specifically that I could hang on? Maybe with Bob Wills. I mean, that's a fascinating case because the solos would so routinely just be amazing.
Right. I can't recall a specific song for you. I wish I could, but, you know, I really can't. I mean, if we're talking rock and roll or something, I can remember more specifics there, you know, but I'm trying to think of something that's...
I mean, you know, one of the things I'm interested in here, too, is that rock and roll, of course, is known for this.
Right.
And I think I admire it for it. But within country and within jazz, I think people either don't know it or they somehow repress the knowledge that, you know, these things were done.
Yeah.
I've talked to, for instance, to George Avakian about sessions with Miles Davis early on he's putting a knife to the thing.
Oh, you bet.
You know.
You bet. You know, I can tell you this. I don't know if this is interesting at all to you, but one thing that does stand out in my mind is that some of the earliest rock and roll edits I've seen were more fix-oriented, where... And I should, okay, let me rephrase that. Not I shouldn't pigeonhole that as rock and roll, but the earlier edits to analog tape that I've seen were not necessarily fix-oriented, because I think that the audience, the producers, the artists, and music in general was much more forgiving back then, and ultimately much more interesting. But rather than being fix-oriented, it was to do something like adding a solo from another take that was particularly fiery, or a vocal phrase that was particularly touching, you know, as opposed to so-and-so sang flat there, let's pick up But Love from this take and put it in, which is what a lot of analog editing
Yeah.
As time went on.
Yeah.
And, you know, I really believe that. I can't off the top of my head, although I'm sure they exist, I can't off the top of my head give you an example of a country recording that I've worked on from the early 50s where something went wrong and they fixed it with an edit as opposed to calling for another take.
Yeah.
But I can remember, not, you know, song by song, but specific instances where I just go, my God, look at this. They took the solo from this one and put it into here, and listen why.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing. Or, like I said, a vocal phrase or a chorus that was particularly, you know, well sung.
Yeah, give me an example of that if you got one on the tip of your head.
You know, boy, I mean, I don't know if I can give you a song by song example, but certainly I did see that happening not often, and I don't mean to, you know, I don't ever want you to think that I'm saying I saw this all the time.
Right.
It wasn't that case. But, you know, with Bob Wills in the early 50s, there were certainly times when that had happened, you know, when someone would just take a solo, and usually an over-the-top solo, you know, and I you know, if I had a day to spend with this stuff before you and I were chatting, I'd be able to zero in on this. But, you know, it wouldn't even be something that was quote-unquote technically proficient, but just something that was so over-the-top. pop mm-hmm. that had it had to go into the song, you know.
Yeah, I would think Bob Wills' sides would make that very tough to be able to cut those things in anyway, you know. Just because he would talk over the top and it, you know, just
yeah. Oh, I'm sure
know, just there. Physically to do it in some cases. Let me ask you one more question, then I'll let you go and tell me about your story of how you came to get the Lefty for Sale project, how you actually received the acetates and tapes. Did you listen to acetates, or was this all already transferred? Did you work with tape? Just tell me how you came to that project.
Okay, well, let me see. Basically, it was done for Sony Legacy. And, you know, there's A&R meetings that are held at Sony Legacy the same way they're held at Sundays and every other record company on the planet, where ideas are basically put out on the table and discussed and fine-tuned and honed and et cetera, et cetera. And everyone knew and was in agreement that there had to be a good Lefty Frizzell compilation out there. Basically, the only things that were out there were, you know, packages that had been done years and years and years ago with pretty lousy transfers, you know, because back in the 60s when people started, you know, packaging country artists' past works that were taken from lacquer sources, the whole MO was to get rid of any semblance of noise, any kind of noise at all. Therefore, they just cut off the whole top end and low end of the performance, and you were left with what the American public to this day thinks a 78 RPM recording sounds like.
Like that.
Right.
You know, which is not what a 78 RPM record sounds like if you have a good 78 RPM record, you know. And the same thing is true of transcription lacquers, but anyway, I'm getting ahead of the story here. I started putting together A&R for the release. I knew pretty much which period I wanted to focus on. You know, I really wanted to focus primarily on the early period. And once I started reviewing it, going over things and looking at things, I really wanted to push for it to be a double disc set.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's... not always, but very often, a tough sell to
right.
a record company that's, you know, marketing driven.
Right, and Rhino already had a pretty good single disc set.
Right, right. You know, and I'll be honest with you, that type of thing doesn't often come into play
mm-hmm.
during the A&R meetings. You know,
okay.
Because every company wants to have their own, every company's convinced they can make it look better, sound better, and market it better.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way it works here at Sundays, too. Off the record,
yeah.
You know, if a label like Collectibles did something,
mm-hmm.
I'd look at the thing and say, I'd do that again in a heartbeat.
Right,
we can
right.
make it sound better, we make it look better, we can market it better, we can get it in more stores, etc.
Yeah.
So that's off the record.
Yeah.
But anyway, I pushed, and eventually it was agreed that we should do a two CD set, and at some point that would be distilled down to a single CD set, which would sell at a lesser price.
Mm-hmm.
And the next step of that is for me to start putting together the A&R for the package, which, you know, has to be centered around the obvious songs, the hits. And then hopefully, I know that this is probably just my opinion, I've always felt and I've always been intrigued that certain greatest hits albums, certain collections of artists' work, live their own life. It's not merely just Buffalo Springfield retrospective, the best of Buffalo Springfield. That album, to me, like hundreds of others, had a very deliberate sequence, a deliberate feel of its own, and became an album unto itself rather than just a collection of an artist's songs. It's the way I've always tried to work when I'm doing a collection.
Yeah.
And the way I do that is by... after you have your centerpiece of the hits and the very obvious songs that have to be there, you try and disengage yourself from popular opinion and what other people would expect you to put on there, and go with your heart and go with what songs you think truly complement the others and what the artist would want people to hear. And indeed, if the artist is still with us, that's the first person you talk to. which is what I did with Lefty, which meant that I needed, you know, probably 2 weeks of studio time where I did nothing but listening.
Mm.
And listening in the truest sense, not by listening to the bogus, horrible sounding records and discs that were out there on him,
right,
but going back to all those original lacquers and playing through them, you know, to get overwhelmed with that feeling.
Yeah.
And there's not a better feeling in the world than when you're sitting there with, you know, a transcription lacquer of a tune that someone's never heard before, and you get the lump in your throat because it's so astounding.
Well, I bet.
You know? And that's it's the best high in the world in my book.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, you know, to answer your question more precisely, everything was taken from the absolute original sources.
Mm-hmm.
Every single transcription lacquer was gone through by me. Every analog recording was gone through by me up to a point. And up to that point, we're talking, you know, early 60s or so, when that part of the set was pretty much predetermined,
yeah,
to be driven by the hits and the, you know, the centerpiece songs at that point.
Yeah.
The earliest part of the disc, probably all of disc one of Lefty Frizzell, was very much discovery time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and the whole process, the technical process of doing that, and the mindset is very, very much different now than it was then. Now, you know, who cares if there's a little bit of noise on the top end?
Right.
You want to hear the cymbals, and you want to hear the low end, you know, because the sounds that they were able to capture to lacquer,
yeah,
was astounding. The dynamic range is jaw-dropping,
mm,
you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's been a delight to talk to you. Thanks for
speaking. Did I help
speaking.
You at all, Mike?
You did, very much.
I hope I wasn't long-winded.
Yeah, no, this is great. Could you give me some direction on how I might find Don Law? Does he live in Nashville?
He's in Nashville, and what I'll do, last I knew he was in Nashville, let me make a couple phone calls to make sure that he is indeed still with us.
Okay.
And, let me see what I can do for you.
That'd be great.
All right. Mike, you know what I want to do? Let me put you back on with Tim out in the office so Tim can get your mailing address and stuff like that so we can send you down a care package.
Fantastic.
All right?
Okay.
And listen, also, as you're writing this thing, if you need anything else, I'm going to be here all day Monday and Tuesday. Feel free.
Okay, I'm going to be working on this thing for a couple of weeks. I've got, you know, some interviews lined. Actually, this afternoon I'm talking to Jerry Wexler about working with Willie Nelson and Doug Sam.
Well, so, it is a privilege to have you interview me.
Well, great.
In that company.
Well, I admire your work.
Well,
and I've talked to several of the people working on some of the Sony material. I talked to, actually, one of the last pieces on a reissue project I did for Pulse, I talked to Bob Belden about his work on Bitches Brew.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so
good. Oh, yeah.
I'm making the rounds.
Oh, that's good. Bob,
everybody in those A&R meetings, you know, that you're talking about.
There you go. Bob and I are old buddies.
He's, is that right?
Oh, he's just insane. You
yeah,
know?
He is. Yeah,
he is,
I know
absolutely
it.
Insane. But, well, listen, you call any time, and anything I can do for you, you let me know.
Thank you so much,
okay,
Bob.
Okay, let me put you on with Tim.
All right.
Okay,
see
hang
you.
On.
Bye.